Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. I'm joined today by Tom McKillicuddy, co-founder of Circa 5000, describing itself as the investment platform of the human future. With a vision of a thriving planet in the year 5000, the company asks us to question whether people will be included in that future, and the answer to a certain human future, impact investing. Circa 5000 offers its customers the chance to invest in the sustainable businesses enriching the planet. Launched in 2019, the company has some 150,000 investors and has had its purposeful credentials recognized through B Corp status. To tell us more, Tom, welcome to Changemakers.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, real pleasure. Now, what I was thinking was that, you know, the band Busted, they went to the year 3000 and they said in the song, I've been to the year 3000, not much has changed. But they lived underwater, and your great-great-granddaughter is pretty fine. Well, you know, let's take that aquatic future and sort of fast forward 1,978 years later to the year 5,000. Let's get in the TARDIS. What's happening, Tom?
I'll give you a joke answer that I said the other day and my actual hopes. The joke answer is Man United have finally won another Premier League title. I think the I'm obviously a United fan, season ticket holder, unfortunately, at the moment. But I think the real answer is just something, you know, relatively simple. I think everybody on Earth has access to good food, good education, housing, clean water, and we've kind of solved the environmental crisis, and we're living in a prosperous kind of version of the future. I think what we kind of stand for is positive futurism. That's what we're trying to do with the brand, with the investments that we make. And so just the basics, all done well and in a good place is what I hope for.
I read something that you said that really got me to think. You said, when you take us out of the picture, the world keeps spinning. The future is bright. We're just not in it. I mean, it's a fairly sort of grim prognosis, isn't it? Of the side of that story.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, I was chatting to a mate of mine who does physics, does nuclear physics, and he says, you know, all the climate change stuff that we talk about like the Earth is going to go extinct, but it's not. It's just us, you know. So what we stand for is investing in companies that kind of make sure that we are thriving here, because the Earth will still be here, still be spinning, and we'll still look great. And if you look at a lot of our brand intentionally, it doesn't have pictures of human beings in it. It just has these kind of beautiful, lush images of the future. And the idea is that we're helping to make sure that we are in that kind of version of the future, but there's no guarantee unless we actually take action.
Well, if we bring ourselves back to 2022, the immediate prognosis doesn't look great when you look at climate change and you look at, you know, many of the challenges facing, you know, sort of humanity and the planet right now. In terms of the immediate things that you see, I mean, are you one of those that sort of thinks, well, you know what, I remain positive because we're going to innovate our way out of this issue? Or is part of the challenge, or part of the kind of like the, you know, the challenge that you're putting out there, to, when you talk about a far off year like that 5,000, circa 5,000, is that part of trying to get people to think about the long term, the big picture, rather than what happens in the next 365 days, which seems to be how the world runs, you know, financially, economically, politically?
It's a fantastic question, observation, because I think in the short term, things don't look fantastic, especially if you're sitting in certain countries where the political situation is not amazing. Our ability to solve problems seems to be getting, you know, worse in the short term. But I think the intention with the year 5000 with the brand is thinking super long term. And I'd still say the evidence suggests that over the long term, humans do kind of innovate and do improve and do solve problems. I mean, there's a lot of more data on that than it going the opposite way. So I still back humanity, back us, back the companies, back governments, ultimately, to get our act together and solve these problems. It may not happen in the next few months, but I think it will 100% happen in the long term. There seems to be a lot of short-term thinking, especially in financial services. You know, we see a lot of trading, almost like gambling on the stock market. We're trying to bring about a renaissance in like proper long-term thinking, I think, with the investments that we make and how we think about our place in the world in the future. So I would still back us to solve these problems over a long time frame, even though it feels quite dark at the moment. But you said at the beginning, I am an optimist. I think you have to be. I think you have to confront reality, but not be pessimistic about it. Because I think pessimism results in inaction, results in like a downward spiral. I think you have to be realistic and optimistic and try and move things forward. I think that's what we try and do.
Let me give you a quote. Wonder if you can name it. Some people don't like change, but you need to embrace change if the alternative is disaster.
Oof, it's a great quote. I'm not...
It comes from one of your great heroes, Elon Musk.
Is it Musk? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, he features heavily in your lockdown list. And of course, he represents, I guess, the Marmite at the moment in terms of superhero or supervillain, as he was asked.
He's become Marmite, and I don't think he's done himself any favours for that, because I think his Twitter presence and some of his more flippant opinions detract from what is probably the greatest entrepreneur, definitely of our lifetimes, if not potentially ever, by the time he's kind of finished, I would say. The way he thinks super long-term about these huge, long-term structural issues, i.e. getting us off this planet just in case we go extinct. That's what he's doing with SpaceX, you know, Tesla, etc. You know, even his earliest startups that became PayPal and internet currencies and things like that. He's very, very long-term and forward-thinking, and he bets his ranch every single time. He takes massive risks, and that's why he's been an inspiration to me as an entrepreneur. You know, take or leave his Twitter presence. I don't really pay attention to that as much. And I think I wish he wouldn't do that bit, because he gives people room to critique him. If you just strip that away, what he's done from an entrepreneurial perspective and for a kind of human existence perspective is undeniable. Mm. And I wish he didn't do that thing around the edges, because it gives people the excuse to batter him over the head.
You've said that he's your inspiration for, and to use in the lockdown list, you talk about him continually rolling the dice with his own money for the benefit of humanity. And I suppose that's what you're saying. But a lot of people will say, but that's the problem, isn't it? Because, you know, he's likely, you know, whether the Twitter deal goes through or not, that what we are seeing is huge levels of responsibility in the hands of people that, you know, haven't been elected. Or, and I realize that there's a great tradition of, you know, entrepreneurs and business leaders that own large parts of the media. And most recently, we've got people like Jeff Bezos owning the Washington Post. But in terms of the role, I guess, of entrepreneurs as the forces for good in this world that you are seeking to influence, this is the moment, isn't it, in terms of the need and the requirement, whatever you think about the kind of democratic deficit or the problems. I mean, is your argument we need a lot more Elon Musk if we're going to get this job done?
100%. Well, I would say that unequivocally. I think the Twitter thing is a bit of non-core activity from him that I wish he kind of hadn't done. And I think if you read between the lines, he's regretting it, because he's trying to basically pull out of the deal, I think, in many ways. I think he shouldn't have gone near that. But I would say the same, really. I would apply that same lens to all the rich people that own media publications, whether it's digital or kind of, you know, more traditional in this country and other countries. I'm not a huge fan of, you know, private individuals having so much kind of say in what people read and how they perceive things. So I think that's something that we need to address. But Elon Musk doing it with Twitter won't be the first time it's been done, and it probably won't be the last, and he won't be the worst. You know, we're kind of infected with very, very wealthy people's opinions all through our kind of media landscape, especially in the UK. But strip that aside, whether you like this or not, in order to solve the problems that we need to solve at the scale we need to solve them, we can't rely on governments and charities. And the private sector is exceptionally good at innovating fast, scaling at speed, solutions to problems, and solutions to problems where there's money on the end of it. So if we can make the world's biggest problems, you know, commercial, you know, opportunities, we can solve them quicker than if they weren't. So I think Musk has proven that with Tesla. They are, you know, the critique of Tesla is it's still cars for rich people, you know, 100%. Hopefully they make them cheaper and cheaper as they get bigger. That's the plan. But I think now it's becoming more and more viable. Companies like Beyond Meat, Oatly, Tesla, these are brand names that you would never have seen 20 years ago that from their DNA are tackling climate or other issues. I think we need a million more of them.
Right. And I suppose a segue into talking about Circa 5000 is, when you look at Tesla, is that the expectation was that Tesla would fade away as the bigger sort of car companies got into electric cars. But of course, in many respects, they've kept those big car companies innovating and changing. Now, your business is very much about motivating the capital markets, the big plumbing of business. So less the entrepreneur, more the kind of those big corporations to be part of the action in terms of real world impact. So in terms of the business and what you're seeking to do with that kind of activist approach, tell us a little bit about how it works.
Yeah, so I mean, the core of what we do, I mean, if you think about, just to back up for a second, success for Tesla was always about dragging the car industry towards electric vehicles, basically, and proving that you can do it. Now every car maker's got an electric version. Now, that's not diminished the power of Tesla. In fact, you just say it's increased it, because their brand is better, they have the better technology, they're the aspirational brand, but it's meant that every car company now is moving in their direction. They've changed the car industry because of what they did, and I think success for us is that in the investment management industry. So the success for us is we build the most powerful consumer retail investing brand. It's all impact investing. And over time, prove that you can generate fantastic financial returns with this feel-good factor. And in doing so, we drag the rest of the industry with us. But that just kind of reinforces our existence and our pull factor to people.
Does it also, because obviously your pitch is made up of investing in a portfolio of purpose-led listed companies that are already on the stock market. So,
yes.
I mean, a lot of people, when they look at their ISAs or their pensions or their savings, increasingly they're becoming much more activist minded. You know, they don't want fossil fuel companies, they don't want automotive companies, they don't want aerospace, lots of things. Do you see those companies as reformable entities that are part of the answer, or are they just irredeemably part of the problem?
Yeah, I think it depends on the company, but I would say that they have to be part of the answer. Because these are huge companies with massive resources. So I'm not necessarily saying good company, bad company in what we're doing. That's not kind of what we're trying to, we're not trying to be morally superior to anybody and say that those are bad, they're not. They served a fantastic purpose and still do, you know, in the current economy. So I think that we need them to transition. A parallel in my industry, our industry, is BlackRock being the biggest asset manager in the world, 10 trillion of assets under management. It's very easy to critique BlackRock, but we need them. We need them to change, basically, because if we're going to address any of these problems, we need them to come with us and change. And then ultimately, we want the world to change in this forward, this direction. So we need them to come with us. So I think it depends on the companies, but I would never rule any of them out in any industry from changing in a positive way.
But I suppose the thing I'm thinking about, I mean, I think interesting that you've mentioned BlackRock. I mean, I think the Larry Fink annual letters make a huge difference in the message to the market. And I've interviewed Sir Nigel Wilson from Legal & General, who I think, you know, is possibly the UK's answer to that in terms of the, you know, the kind of profit with purpose argument. I mean, you're basically investing on the grounds of return, reward, risk, but also impact. And I suppose the thing that a lot of people talk about in terms of purpose-led businesses is that there's a difference between the plumbing and the poetry. Mm. So the poetry is, it's a fantastic speech and it's really interesting to listen to. And that might be a letter or it might be a great sort of initiative. But the real plumbing is about the demonstrable change in action and impact. Mm. How do you know that you're winning? How do you know that you are backing the right types of company in terms of how you dig into it?
That's a great question. Yeah, because I think for us, being to be able to demonstrate that is in an integral part to our brand, and we'll be, you know, we'll determine whether we succeed or not and whether we are viewed as authentic ourselves. So we have our own data. We work with some third parties on research and data. And basically what we do is we have a 27-28 page report on per company where we dig into the positive impacts and the negative impacts. And we effectively, you know, weight those against each other and try and invest in companies that pass a certain threshold for positive net impact on the planet. Mm. That encompasses everything from the products and service they sell, who they sell it to, their supply chains, their management, everything. So there's every factor of a company baked into kind of a data point, an overall data point. And then it's our aspiration to only invest in the companies that are having the most positive impact on a net basis. So we use things like one of the easiest ways for people who are not in the industry to understand the first sift point for us is, where does the company get its revenue from? So that separates out the corporate social responsibility statement from the thing you sell, because the most important thing is the thing you sell, not what you say, effectively. So we want, if we're investing in a housing company, it has to be a housing company that's building affordable homes for certain types of demographics. We need that as a data point. Then we can look at the rest of the business, then we can weigh that out, and then we can choose to invest or not in that kind of business. So we're looking for pure play, net positive impact businesses from a revenue perspective.
Right. And the customer gets a choice within that, right? In terms of people or planet or
people,
both.
Planet, or they can build their own thing from whatever they want. So if they like the idea of sustainable food companies but are not that bothered about clean water, for example, in the climate stuff, they can swap those out and bring in more of a people theme and build their own thing. But generally, people and planet and every area kind of that's made up from those two overarching themes.
You know, I'm reading here something you said, that when we invest our wealth into responsible businesses, it's all about them seeing the value in our continued existence. In terms of how you make that specific, in terms of, because, you know, I would have thought that, you know, a lot of companies would buy into our continued existence as a good thing, but I suppose that, you know, it's down to deeds, not words, isn't it, in terms of how you're monitoring and how you're making sure sure that, this continues to be the responsible business that you believe in? Yeah. I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, that's quarterly basis. There's a big deep dive on an annual basis because a lot of companies report their impact specifically on an annual basis. They report financially on a quarterly and annual basis, but the impact information comes annually. So I would say it's the deepest of deep dives on an annual basis, but we monitor them constantly. It's very rare that a company whose DNA is to solve X problem, who only sells Y product, change so much that they're no longer an impact business. Something may come in which may make us question them. Something in the supply chain may have happened which may make us reassess the overall nature of the business. But it's very rare for a pure play business that's selling this undeniably positive thing to switch entirely.
Right.
But we are scouring the world for companies that make positive steps.
And those are the ones I'm interested in, because I think, you know, it strikes me that you've got B Corps, you've got a whole range of, you know, ethically minded businesses where this is written into their articles of association, tick in the box. You've got businesses that are making steps that presumably at some point pass a threshold where they become interesting to you. And the thing I'm sort of thinking about is that how do you know you're not a victim of greenwashing when, you know, ever more sophisticated companies that are able to tell a pretty good yarn versus actually ever more sophisticated companies that are actually doing really, really good things?
Yeah, I mean, the greenwashing for me has become like synonymous with ESG investing, environmental, social and governance risk factor investing. So we don't really stray near ESG, if I'm totally honest, because that is ripe for greenwashing. Because for as an example, banks. So banks score very well on G, governance. Ever since the financial crisis, the governance has always been exceptionally good. They have very little E and S to kind of report, environmental and social risk, really. So they always score very well on ESG. And so they feature in ESG portfolios.
Right.
But I think when people think, when people who are not in the investment management industry think ESG, they think companies solving climate change or companies solving social problems. And then they see, you know, big global bank and they're like, well, that's a bit strange. That's not what I thought it was. That's the greenwashing area for me, because what ESG doesn't do is assess the revenue and the impact of that revenue on the world. It just assesses whether the company is a good corporate citizen and is exposed to any risks on these three kind of elements. And therefore, you get a lot of big tech companies, big banks in, because they pass the sift on those factors. And that is the area of greenwashing that's most rife for me at the moment that I see. And if you're a consumer and wanting to look at investing in these kinds of funds, one of the biggest things and favors you can do for yourself is just look at the top 5 or 10 holdings. And that'll tell you everything you need to know about what you're actually investing in. Because if it's bank, tech companies, and then ExxonMobil's often in there because it scores well on G and certain things, that's when you know it's not really what you think it is and you should try and find something else.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, I've read what you've said about ESG and, you know, you've spoken about how Ukraine has exposed a flaw in this regard. But of course, the idea has taken hold in terms of, you know, I mean, I remember when I first heard the acronym ESG, I was like, what is that? You know, and now, of course, it's a major part of how financial services businesses are reporting and presenting themselves. Is it the case that we should just abandon the label, or can you actually get in there and reform it and make it more meaningful so that the E and the S do have the weighting that you're talking about?
Yeah, in fact, there are discussions going on in the industry about, you know, ESG, they say 2.0, I don't want to put the 0.0 on the end, but ESG 2, which is, it considers more of the actual revenue and the actual impact within that. I think the acronym as it is today, or the practice as it is today, is being used in the way I describe it in the investment management industry as a way to continue doing what they've always done and what they've always invested in, whilst ticking the box of, and we are environmentally, socially conscious. So maybe, but I kind of agree what the Schroders CEO said a year or two ago, which is, I think the market over the next 5 years will kind of see ESG for what it is and quickly move on past it to impact. And ESG will become of second, third, fourth order importance in a way of assessing a business. Because I'm not saying it's completely unimportant. I'm just saying it's not what people think it is. So you don't want to invest in companies that have governance risk or risk in the supply chain or some environmental risk. You don't want that either. But what I think people want is business models that are addressing.
Yeah, and I'm still thinking, you know, there's that saying, let a thousand flowers bloom, which is, I suppose, that there are areas here, but, you know, there are other areas that, you know, you're interested in, like pensions, you know, where, you know, you've got huge sort of areas of where capital could be redeployed around an idea. And I suppose the question that I sort of feel is that, even with a business like yours, which has done very well in terms of where you've got it to thus far, it's still, I guess, scratching at the surface in terms of the massive systemic changes that are going to have to happen to actually mend the planet. And that means mending the system in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. We're still someone that the asset management industry can ignore still, you know? Mm. So I think we need to be much, much bigger. A few key steps in that, you mentioned pensions. We're going really large on pensions from the beginning of this year, kind of onwards, since we launched our own pension, where people can consolidate their old workplace pensions in our investments and invest in really positive investments in the background, align their pensions with how they see the future. And for most people, they have, even of our target demographic, which is about the average age of 31, they have about 15, 20 grand or more in old workplace pensions. So it's the biggest pot of money that young people have, and they don't know what it's invested in. And oftentimes they don't even know they have it or where it is. So we're trying to shine a light on that, bring some transparency to that, because if you can nudge that industry, that's where the bulk of people's money is, you have a massive impact. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is, in the background of our investments today, we use some third-party funds from other asset managers that have been constructed with impact in mind. But as of October this year, all the funds will have been built from scratch by us. So we'll no longer be reliant on anything from the asset management industry, and everything will have been built from the ground up by us. So that's a big flag in the ground moment from us, which does put us in, I would say, it brings us more into the front of mind of some of the bigger asset management houses, because we're directly going for them now by saying that we can create something much better than what they have.
Now you mentioned younger people as part of that answer. 90% of your users are in the 24 to 39 age bracket.
Yeah.
And also first-time investors. What do you feel about that? Is that the future? Do you want to go out into other age demographics, or actually is this what the brand is there to service, this next generation of people that are going to build the planet?
Yeah, I think it was always our first initial foray into the market, because that's who we are in the team. That's who I'm now at the slightly older end of that kind of age bracket, but that's me. I think we originally did that because we felt like we understood how to market to those people and build a product for those people, because it was us. But I think, as you've seen, as we've grown, we started to attract older customers, because I don't think these values and this way of thinking is confined to a generation. I think it's very pronounced in certain generations, but it's by no means exclusive to an age demographic. And I think that there's a lot of people, 40s and 50s, that now invest with us that are some of our biggest customers, because they obviously have more money to invest, but they are more aware of what investing is. They've been investing for a while, and they now realize that this is the future and they want to do it this way. So I think we will broaden out. And if you look at the product development and the actual look and feel of the product and the brand now, it has grown up considerably since we first launched,
because
we've realized that it's not confined to, you know, 30-year-olds. It can be anybody who cares about these issues.
Well, I was going to say, because it strikes me that consciousness is a big part of this, right, isn't it, in terms of people becoming activated because they become aware of the issues around them, and the consciousness that actually things like money matters, right? You know, I mean, I interviewed Richard Curtis, you know, Make My Money Matter is his campaign. And I suppose you're part of a movement which is about making money matter. I mean, and how do you think you're doing on that in terms of that, this kind of broader challenge of public consciousness and how you awaken it?
I think we're doing okay. I'm our biggest critic, naturally, you know, because I'm impatient and I can see where we can go. I think where it always comes home to me is when we do events with our customers. You know, obviously, we're a digital business, so we don't meet our customers one by one. Wouldn't be scalable to do so, but we do events, we do online events, and we do a lot of surveying and feedback. Mm. And what they say back to us about what it's helped them do and how it's changed their mindset about investing, what money is proof that we're onto something, basically. And I think the limiting factor for us is budget and marketing and getting the word out, because unlike, I'll mention them again, not because they're the only people in the world, but BlackRock, they can spend, you know, $1 billion on X and it wouldn't even register. You know, we have to prove out our model over and over again, over time, raise money and expand. So we're only a couple of years into our journey. I think judge us on a 10-year time frame, and I think by then we will have really had an impact on the industry. And I think because of, even though I'd say our overall assets under management may never be the size of a BlackRock, I think that we can shout above our asset weight because of the number of customers we have, the social media presence, the brand factor. So I think we can feel like a big player without being one in the next few years.
But I suppose the other thing is that this also now speaks to Tom, the entrepreneur, the person in a hurry, the person with a passion for a project. You know, the kind of the great attraction that people have to entrepreneurial businesses. So back to what we were speaking about at the beginning of this interview in terms of the Elon Musk factor. I mean, are you the Elon Musk of the financial services industry?
I wouldn't ever say that because unlike Elon, I don't think I have some kind of genius. I really don't. I think my mum and dad brought me up to do the basics exceptionally well. I think that's me. I like to learn, like to work hard. That on repeat can produce something, I think. But I don't think I have the engineering genius of Elon Musk, so I would never, ever, ever compare myself to someone like
that. It could have been a good Vox spot for the interview, but you have spoken about business being a numbers, stamina, and resilience game. I mean, that does speak to the, you know, 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. I mean, 100%. In terms of what you've learned about yourself along the way, I mean, I was very taken by your quote for life, which was don't take anything anyone say to you personally, good or bad. How's that manifested itself for you as a business builder?
Yeah, I think one of our team members described me a month or so ago as the most stoic person he'd ever met. And I think I've learned that over time. I think some of my family have that naturally, but I don't let any news affect me anymore, good or bad, because I know that good or bad news is right around the corner. Matt is the founder. We used to talk about it's good hour, bad hour. Amazing news, terrible news. And my job, I feel, is to just constantly stay in the middle, take everything in my stride and move forward. You're always a conversation or two away from a solution to a problem is what I've learned over the past few years.
Oh, what a great piece of advice that is. And you've got to keep the middle of the fulcrum.
Just keep in the middle, keep going, back yourself and just stay the course. I mean, that we feel like we've become very, very resilient, I'd say, and hell-bent on those kind of principles that help us, I think, in dark times.
Do you think this is what gives you a one handicap in golf?
Yeah, because that is a sport where you have to be resilient and not get frustrated with yourself. I would say that I get way more frustrated playing golf on my own than I do managing the business, I have to say, because there's something uniquely infuriating about golf, I think.
Well, I can't remember who said it, but there's a great golf phrase, which is about the importance of playing the course, not the player. I mean, is that an analogy that works in your own business in terms of what it is, the onward journey for Circa 5000 in terms of what you need to do and what you need to achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there are a lot of things from golf and sport generally. I used to play a lot of football, I played rugby, but football and golf being my main sports that especially in a startup, especially in a company that's quite a small size, that you can learn from. And I think golf, patience and staying calm and moving forward, definitely, definitely true.
Let's finish not on a question about Manchester United. Well, tempting as it is, but your best tip for life: delete your social media, go outside. Give a tip to listeners, Tom. Hopefully, they're going to take this podcast with them when they go outside.
Like I'm becoming my dad, you know, with all these things I say. Actually, I deleted my. I've deleted most of my social media. I still have some of the accounts, so it appears like I have them. But Facebook wiped, Instagram don't use. I feel like there's two schools of thought. There's like the metaverse is being created. We're all going to live in this digital world. I don't want any part to play in that, if I'm totally honest. And I think there's a lot to be said for like traditional things.
So you've got a lonely digital twin somewhere in the metaverse.
Yeah, like go and see your family and friends. Go and do something outside. Eat some decent food. Sleep. I think these are all, you know, age-old advice that's just ever more true today.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks very much, Tom. Listen, thank you for sharing your story, the story of Circa 5000, and such a... I think a motivating and positive vision about the things we can do to create the future we all want. Thank you so much for joining me on Changemakers.
It's been great. Loved it. Thank you very much.
Changemakers is brought to you by the campaigns firm Seven Hills and presented by me, Michael Heyman. Pure Being is the name of our soundtrack and it's written and performed by the brilliant BT Wolf. To find out more, head over to changemakers.works. And if you like what you hear, why not give us a rating?